This is a Shadowcast Audiobooks feature presentation. Eyes and Knives by Pete Malicki. About the author. Pete Malicki is an Australian author who started writing at the age of 18, achieving early success when he won a nationwide playwriting competition with his first ever play, The New Inhabitant. He went on to complete 5 full-length novels, 20 plays, short stories, poetry, and song lyrics, and he has had articles published online, in magazines, and in newspapers such as the Sydney Morning Herald. In 2009, Pete founded his own independent publishing company, Helm Publishing, and printed this, his fourth novel, Eyes and Knives. When he's not writing, he runs a natural therapies business in Sydney and gets attacked by his pet ferret, Matilda. About the book, Eyes and Knives was born from an amalgamation of Pete's various interests, from genetic engineering to elaborate scams to corporate wrongdoing. It was written in 2004 and abandoned until several years later, when the decision to publish it was made. Described as a real page-turner, action-packed and slickly written, wickedly humorous, Eyes and Knives has as much action as a John Woo feature film. As reviewer from thewritersbeat.com said, the diabolical plot tosses you onto a razor's edge and forces you to run along it until you know what happens next. Suspense is the name of the game here, and Malicki does an excellent job of combining sharp, determined writing with a page-turning story. And now it is my pleasure to present to you Eyes and Knives by Pete Malicki. Episode 1. Tuesday, afternoon. In the final minutes before he died, Paul Hirsch was bored. This was somewhat appropriate, given that he spent his final minutes in a board meeting. His final seconds were spent hurtling towards the ground from the 20th floor of the building he worked in. While Paul had been alive, he'd worked as an executive manager for a large corporation, a corporation whose sole focus was profit. Where one organization might shy away from a particular deal because they were concerned with ethics, Paul's corporation would be there, with open pockets, smiling faces, and a well-oiled PR team. There might even be a conspiracy theorist out there who claimed they were involved in activities that made your run-of-the-mill corruption look like child's play. Some people say money doesn't make you happy. You can't buy love and friendship with plastic notes and pieces of metal. These people would claim that being a puppet in a large, profit-driven corporation with no moral standards is enough to pull the thread of one's conscience to the breaking point. One day you might reflect on what you do for a living and think, "Hey, I'm the scum of the earth. Where's a bridge I can drive my Audi off of?" But Paul Hirsch wasn't one for self-doubt. He loved his job. He loved his job. He loved his expensive car. He loved the gorgeous woman who had married him for his status. And most of all, he loved his money. What he wasn't particularly fond of was board meetings, because they bored him to death. Well, not literally. At least, not often. This particular board meeting had something to do with retention and staff incentives. The workers in the call center had been complaining about the high level of abuse they copped from disgruntled clients, so the senior management team was coming up with ways to placate them. Offer them rewards for excellent service, give them discount vouchers or tickets to the movies, award them a commission for every new client they sign up, hire some massage guys to rub their shoulders once a month. None of these ideas would make a real difference, though. This corporation had better things to do with its time than worry about staff. Paul Hirsch lost the thread of the meeting somewhere around upgrading the lunchroom coffee machine. He let his thoughts drift over his colleagues' breasts. They were nice breasts. Paul had given them an 8 out of 10, top marks for their curvy shape, a size and fullness that any bikini model would be proud of, and several packed elevator rides had confirmed a good level of suppleness. She lost the 2 points on the way her nipples pointed outwards. Occasionally, when breast enhancement surgery went awry, the silicone implants would be inserted so that it displaced the nipples laterally. Jenna Albright, for that was her name, had never undergone breast surgery, but most of the men from the senior management team would have bet their own mothers that she had. When Jenna had caught Paul staring, he'd quickly turned his gaze to his coffee mug, the mug with the name of his corporation emblazoned on it. Star Market Systems, it said in gold and black text. This mug was the last thing he ever remembered. Without warning, Paul Hirsch leapt to his feet, knocking his mug onto the carpet where it smashed into 5 or 6 jagged pieces. The entire senior management team stopped their creative brainstorming and looked up at him. If there's one thing you can do to get attention, it's breaking something. What are you doing, Paul? Asked the head of communications. Paul was vainly attempting to overturn the mahogany meeting table. He grunted and growled like a hurt animal, then abruptly ceased his efforts and dropped into a crouch. The man to his right, a long-standing manager at Star Market Systems, jumped up and stumbled behind his chair, afraid that Paul would attack him. Is this supposed to be a suggestion on how we can improve staff morale, Paul? Because I don't understand. The CEO trailed off as he watched his most senior manager run at full speed toward the window. There was a dull thud, followed by a chorus and gasp from the table. The window did not shatter, but a long crack appeared in the glass, spreading out like the forked branches of a lightning bolt. Paul Hirsch half turned toward the senior management team, snarled as he looked from face to face. Before anyone moved, he turned back to the window and started punching it. The crack widened, and shards showered out, creating a hole large enough for him to leap out of. He leaped. Tuesday. Evening. Did you hear that, honey? Some guy fell out of a 30-story building and almost landed on a pram. Apparently the mother abandoned her baby and ran off at full speed. She hasn't been seen since. Rod Fitzgerald hated his wife. He hated the way she slouched on the lounge, peering at the TV screen over the rim of her glass of gin. He hated the way she paraphrased the news, firstly, because she dumbed everything down as if he were an idiot, and secondly, because he could hear it anyway. He hated the vast number of outfits she wore, and he hated her inability to stick with an activity for more than 2 weeks. He hated her obnoxious laugh, and he hated her parents. He hated her best friend because she was superficial and boring, and looked like she had been beaten into a coma with an ugly stick. Are you listening to me, Rodney Fitzgerald? He hated the way she referred to him by his full name. No, dear, I'm not, Rod replied pleasantly. Would you like some dinner with your liver cancer? Jennifer Fitzgerald tipped the dregs of her gin into her mouth and swallowed. She insisted on being called Jennifer rather than Jenny or Jen, and Rod hated that too. As long as it isn't that shitty pasta you usually make, she said. Rod looked at the meal he had just made. He ladled out a plateful of shitty pasta and took it to the study. Suit yourself, he called as he switched on his laptop. 7 seconds later, the computer was up and running and ready to go. It was a supercomputer, the likes of which are normally owned by governments and intelligence agencies. Rod didn't work for the government, but for Star Market Systems. If you looked at his official documentation, you'd be thoroughly convinced that Rod Fitzgerald worked in the call center of a multinational marketing corporation. You would believe that he was on a generous salary of $72,000 per annum, with entitlements and year-round discount parking. If you looked hard enough, you might even catch a sniff or a brief affair with the boss's teenage daughter. What you wouldn't find, in any documents anywhere, is that Rod Fitzgerald worked as a scientist in the R&D department of the world's largest technology company. You'd have no idea that he was on a yearly salary of over $1 million, which didn't include his expensive sports cars and his personal doctor. And you certainly wouldn't find even the slightest hint that he had 4 kills under his belt. Rod opened the document he was currently working on. It was a presentation on how DNA could be replicated indefinitely without a reduction in size of the telomeres. He hated that his wife was so fucking stupid she actually believed he made enough money from telemarketing to buy a sports car, but he loved the fact that he had deceived her so successfully she didn't even know his real name. Honey, I'm sorry I was rude about your cooking. I'm really quite fond of your pasta. Jennifer was standing in the doorway, a plate of spaghetti in one hand and a fork in the other. Years of drinking and smoking had left her much worse off than when Rod had selected her, but the various exercise programs she undertook had kept her body in serviceable shape. Come here, Jennifer, Rod said as he swiveled his chair around to face the door. Show me just how sorry you are. His 32-year-old wife slipped across the room and sat down on his lap, grinding her firm hips back and forth. Do you like it when I do this, honey? Rod hated how his wife always asked him if he liked what she was doing. Yeah, I like it, he replied honestly. You know what else I like, don't you? Silence. I know. He smiled and grabbed Jennifer by the shirt, bringing her mouth close to his. Seconds later, they were kissing enthusiastically and tearing each other's clothes off. Rod Fitzgerald hated his wife, but he still loved watching her face while she rode his genetically enhanced cyber penis. Wednesday, early morning. Tickets, please. A young man named Rory Henderson took a sharp breath. He clenched his jaw tight and his eyes darted around the carriage. There was no escape. He had to think of something quickly. He leaned back and feigned sleep. Sir, your ticket, please. Sir? Sir! Huh? What's up? Rory rubbed his bleary eyes and looked at the young man standing before him. He was tall, but his build was slight. A dark blue uniform and a badge in his left hand identified him as a transit officer. That is, a glorified ticket inspector. Rory was sure he could take him. "Can I see your ticket, please?" "Shit, I must have fallen asleep. What station are we at?" "Almost Helm, sir. Your ticket?" "Helm? Damn, I missed my stop." The inspector reached for his radio at the same time that Rory clambered to his feet. "I wouldn't try to leave, sir. I'm going to have to write you a ticket."
"Hey, that's not fair, mate. I fell asleep and missed my stop."
"Can you show me your ticket?" Rory looked at the man's radio. Inspectors traveled in groups, and it wouldn't be wise to attack one of them.
"I lost it. My wallet was stolen."
The inspector smiled a humorless smile.
"Was it really?
You won't be able to bribe me then, will you? What a shame." He started filling out one of the forms from his notebook, ignoring Rory's bewildered look.
"Bribe you? Hey, you know, I might have a bit of money in my sock."
Rory wasn't sure if the inspector was being serious or sarcastic, so he kept his tone lightly jocular. Was attempting to bribe a rail inspector considered an offense? Could he end up owing the bloody government even more money?
$50 will do you fine. No pun intended.
$50? Rory repeated as he reached into his pants and pulled out his wallet.
I think that's a reasonable price, sir.
It is 75% reduction on the overall cost of the fine. You won't need to worry about your criminal record either. The train was nearing Helm Station.
Is this a trick? Because you can't make that kind of offer. It's entrapment.
Give me your name or your money, sir. Rory Henderson took a $50 bill out of his wallet and handed it to the inspector, who took it wordlessly and left the carriage. The train pulled to a stop at Helm, and the inspector alighted. Rory looked out the window. Four burly transit officers were boarding the train. His jaw dropped as he watched the guy he'd just bribed run away at full speed. Wednesday, morning. It was barely light, and the city streets were already crammed full of people. Most of them had just roused from the daily coma of train travel, the perfection of their business outfits contrasting with the glazed look in their eyes. Saul had been staying on the streets for such a long time that he saw right through these people. To him, they were rats, willing to do just about anything to get what they wanted. You'd never catch Saul supplicating to a machine or speaking to an enraged and unreasonable client with false sincerity. He may occasionally eat leftover McDonald's from garbage bins, but he had his pride. Right now, the homeless man was captivated by the sight of the young woman standing outside the electronics store, staring intently at a flickering television set. Her clothes looked new, though her trousers were torn right down one side. There was dried blood caked to her hands, and her weight clearly favored one leg. Saul watched as the man approached this woman, frowning with concern as he eyed her disheveled appearance. He was dressed casually and looked about 30.
"Excuse me, ma'am, are you all right?"
The woman wheeled around to face the man, hissing, and dropped into a crouch. She made an attempt to move forwards but lost her footing, crashed awkwardly onto her chest and face. She crawled to her knees as the man rushed over to assist her.
"Let me help you. Were you attacked?"
The events that happened next were so bizarre that Saul wondered if he hadn't eaten a bad cheeseburger. The man, who had been bending over to help the woman up, suddenly jerked backwards and spun around. For no discernible reason, he started running, and he continued running until he was out of sight. At the same time, the woman convulsed violently on the concrete, arms and legs kicking out in all directions. Then suddenly, she was still. After what seemed like minutes, but it was probably more like seconds, she dragged herself into a sitting position and looked around the street, clearly disoriented.
"What happened?" she mumbled. "Where am I?"
The woman climbed to her feet, wincing and frowning at the pains in her legs and hands. From her body language, it looked very much like she had just woken up.
"My baby! Where's my baby?"
She took a few desperate steps, then collapsed as her leg gave way beneath her. Saul frowned, bit his lower lip, and shuffled away as the woman started shrieking at the top of her voice. Wednesday, early afternoon. Ian Albright counted his takings. $1,230, a pretty girl's phone number, and a packet of gum. Not bad for the middle of the week. Not bad at all. The tall man stripped out of his stolen transit officer's uniform and dressed in something more casual. He threw his wig of long brown hair on the carpet and strode into the kitchen, where he quickly made and ate a jam sandwich. Leaving the plate for his girlfriend to wash up, he strolled into the lounge room, sat down, and turned on the television. A celebrity chef smiled at the camera, and the ads came on. First up was a news update, and it reminded Ian of something he'd seen in the paper that morning. He took out his phone and dialed.
"Yo, sis, what's going on?"
30 kilometers away, a woman sighed into her phone.
"Ian, what do you want? I don't have time to keep you entertained. "There's no need to be so bad-tempered," Ian said good-naturedly. "I heard on the news about some guy falling out of a building in the city. Thought you might have seen some blood and guts or something." The woman sighed. "Listen to me, little brother. I'm very busy. Some of us, the ones who have jobs, don't have the luxury of sitting around all day making pointless phone calls. We live in a pretty large city, and I don't see every little thing that happens in it, okay?"
"It looked like the building you worked in to me," Ian countered.
"Uh-huh. Oops, my other phone's ringing. See you later."
"I made $1,200, Ian said quickly, but the call had already been disconnected.
He continued anyway.
"Yeah, well, some of us have jobs we're not supposed to talk about, bitch."
Throwing his mobile onto the carpet, Ian picked up the remote and changed to Oprah. He lay down on the couch and stared blankly at the ceiling, letting his mind roam free. It's a well-known fact that everyone has a secret. Sometimes they're small and insignificant, sometimes they're monumental. Either way, they always affect the person keeping them. Most people have secrets about themselves, little things they've said or done that they're ashamed to speak about. An example? A man named Billy Winter had been married for 35 years before he died in a rock fishing accident, never telling a single soul about the brief affair he'd had with his math teacher, Miss Benedict. This kind of secret was easy to keep, because Billy didn't want anyone to know about it. Secrets about other people tend not to remain secrets for very long, because there's such a strong temptation to disclose them. Had Billy told either of his children about the aforementioned liaison, they would have almost certainly told their mother at some point in time. If you don't tell anyone your secret, they can't betray you. Ian's thoughts drifted to his own secret. It fit better in the monumental category than in the insignificant one. He disliked the fact that he couldn't even tell his sister what his secret was. She had remained one of his closest friends throughout his life, and it cut him every time he lied and said he was on welfare. The closest thing he got to telling the truth was when he laughingly told her he was employed by the government. A buzzing sound roused Ian from his thoughts. His phone was vibrating around in small circles on the carpet, a light flashing on its screen. He stooped down to pick it up.
"Yeah."
"Ian, we just received an interesting report. Clean yourself up and come to the office immediately."
"Righto."
Ian got up off the couch and rushed to his bedroom, where he changed into a singlet and some very short shorts. Minutes later, he left the house jogging. Wednesday, midday.
"Fuck!"
yelled Rod Fitzgerald as he stepped full force on the brake pedal. The coffee, which had been sitting in his lap, bounced against the steering wheel and exploded, showering hot liquid all over his arms and clothes. Incensed, the scientist from Star Market Systems flung the driver's side door open with the full intention of screaming his lungs out at the fool who had just stepped out in front of his vehicle. As he was struggling out of his seatbelt, a car came screeching into him from behind. Inertia caused Rod's head to smash violently into the frame of the door, and he blacked out for an instant. A second later, a motorist slammed into his open door and went flying through the air. The bike skidded across the road, and Rod's door came off one of its hinges. Rod pulled off his seatbelt and climbed out onto the ground, stumbling towards the car that had just rear-ended him. It was a struggle to stay on his feet. His vision danced, and sound came to him in throbbing waves.
"Are you okay, brother?" came a man's voice.
I don't know, Rod managed in reply. He slumped against the side of his car and took a few deep, even breaths.
"I'm so sorry about that, man. You just hit the brake so hard I couldn't avoid running into the back of you, man. Man, what's with a dick running across a four-lane road? Look at this. He's caused a major fucking accident. Whoa, look out!"
Rod slowly turned around. A man wearing leather and a cracked motorcycle helmet was limping towards him, holding a metal pipe in his hand. Even in his dazed state, he knew that this was the motorcyclist coming to get him.
"Leave him alone, man. It wasn't his fault. Don't make me call the cops on you."
The motorcyclist, Aaron Knowles, didn't slow down a step. At this point in time, he didn't give the slightest toss about the police. He was focused on one thing and one thing only, and that was knocking a half a dozen teeth out of the motherfucker who had just opened his car door without looking to see who might be coming up on his inside. Lots of cyclists and motorcyclists had been hurt or even killed by people doing this, and Aaron was ready to deal out vengeance on all their behalves. But there was something Aaron didn't know. There was a lesson he had never learned, and it proved to be his downfall. If you've ever met a really good fighter, you would know the importance of not judging books by their covers. The common perception is that martial arts is practiced solely by adolescents, steroid-pumping meatheads, and little Chinese guys with long white goatees and flared shirts. This perception is, mostly, a false one. What most people don't consider is that there are some pretty ordinary-looking characters out there who could break both your arms faster than you can count to four. It could be a 5-foot accountant, a bald man, or an overweight woman. Aaron Knowles had never considered this. Hence he came at Rod with full confidence and no apprehension. Rod Fitzgerald was an average-looking guy. He was 40 years old, a fraction under 6 feet, wore an expensive suit, and had short brown hair with a swirl of gray in it. He was well-proportioned, but carried a few extra kilos. Not exactly what you'd describe as menacing. Aaron took a wild swing at Rod's head with a metal pipe he'd removed from his bike. A few seconds later, Aaron had learned his lesson. Even in his dazed state, Rod easily managed to duck his attacker's blow and catch the pipe on his backswing. He wrenched it free and whirled it around to crash down on Aaron's helmet, knocking him onto the ground. An old reflex then made him drop his weight elbows first onto the bigger man's hamstring, a technique that would have anyone limping for days, but wouldn't cause permanent damage. More than a dozen people were watching as Rod climbed woozily to his feet. He looked around, noting at least 6 other cars had been involved in the accident. When the bike had skidded onto the far side of the road, it had hit 2 cars and caused a third to swerve into a phone booth.
"Holy shit! You fucking wasted that dude! Where'd you learn to do those crazy moves, man?"
Rod turned to the excitable young man standing before him and scowled. Given what he'd just done to the motorcyclist, his scowl looked particularly unfriendly. "Church," he said. He staggered over to his car and climbed inside, ignoring the many eyes that followed his movements. There was no point hanging around and wasting his time with the police. It seemed unlikely with all the excitement that anyone would have bothered taking his registration number down, so he'd be able to drive off without getting caught. The engine was still on, much to the amazement of the spectators. Rod Fitzgerald started driving, maneuvering his damaged car away from the scene of the accident. Because, you see, he still had a fool to scream his lungs out at. In the few minutes since causing the accident, the so-called fool had made good distance. His high speed was partly because of the mayhem he had just caused, and partly to do with the fact that he thought he was about to die. He thought over and over, "If I don't keep running, I'm going to die. If I don't keep running, I'm going to die." A car pulled up beside him as he half-jogged and half-stumbled his way along. One of his doors was scraping along the road, leaving a trail of sparks in its wake.
"What the hell do you think you're doing, buddy?" said the driver. "You ruined my damn car!"
"I'm sorry," the man replied breathlessly. "But I couldn't help it. I'm going to die if I stop moving."
Rod snorted.
"What? Is your heart pedal-powered or something?"
He turned in a wide semicircle and started jogging back in the direction he'd come. When he glanced back, he noticed with much dismay that the car was reversing towards him.
"Leave me alone, please," he begged. "It's a matter of life and death."
"Don't give me that shit. You have a pretty big damage bill to pay."
"Listen, I beg you, listen to me and trust what I say. Some crazy guy ran up to me on the street and grabbed me, just grabbed me for no reason. Then I got this voice in my head. It told me that if I slow down below 5 kilometers per hour, I'll explode, like in that movie Speed with the bus. Except that it's with me."
Rob Fitzgerald hated it when people lied to him.
"That's pretty funny, buddy. Can I see the bomb?"
"There isn't any bomb."
"Right. So what, pray tell, is going to make you explode?"
"I don't know. I just know that if I stop..."
Rod didn't catch the rest of what the crazy fool was saying, because someone was blaring their horn at him. He realized he was about to reverse into a parked taxi, so he hit the brakes. A centimeter further and he'd have caused a prang. The taxi driver, who'd been sitting in his car, started yelling abuse out the window. He'd been on his way to work, where he had an important presentation to make. It was now 12:15, and it didn't look like he was even going to make it to the office by 12:30, let alone be ready to present. His fellow senior managers didn't like it when people were late. In all likelihood, they'd refuse to pay his car's damage bill as punishment. Rod poked his head out of the space where he'd once had a door and looked around to see where the delusional, accident-causing idiot had gone off to. He would have to pay for all this. The idiot was crossing a narrow alleyway. As he stepped off the gutter, he stumbled, then completely lost his footing and fell on his face. Seconds later, the surrounding area was sprayed with the man's guts as he exploded into thousands of fleshy pieces. Wednesday, late morning. Rory Henderson sat on the train, clutching his ticket like a sword. He was ready to stab it through the heart of the Dick's ticket inspector foolish enough to cross his path. Today was shaping up to be a pretty lousy day. After being scammed of $50 by a fake transit officer and fined 4 times as much by a team of real ones, the stocky man had gone home to get changed for work. He'd spent the previous night at his girlfriend's place in the city, and had to go all the way back to his mum's house to put some decent clothes on. It was a pain to travel so far when he started within walking distance of his workplace, but coming dressed in shorts, thongs, and a singlet would do nothing for his dreams of promotion. His boss wasn't a very tolerant person. When Rory arrived back home, he couldn't help but notice that his house wasn't there anymore. In his place was a smoking pile of debris. The police at the scene, one day you have a house, the next you have a scene, told him that the fire started in the kitchen and got out of control, namely because no one was around to control it. The moral of the story is this: don't trust your mother to turn the oven off before she goes out for the night. After a few minutes of open-mouthed staring, Rory realized he'd just become homeless. This made a promotion even more important. Vowing to impart a few colorful words upon his mother when he finished work, he started to run back toward the train station. "Wait a second," one of the police officers on the scene had called, but he hadn't a second to spare. To make his morning all the more frustrating, Rory didn't see a single transit officer on his way to the city. Also, when he got off the train and left the platform, the ticket gates were open. With a muttered threat to Murphy, he headed over to the large telemarketing firm he worked in and caught a lift to the 15th floor.
"You're over 2 hours late, son,"
his boss said the moment he arrived in the textbook-designed open-plan office.
"And you look like you haven't slept in a week. Where are your work clothes?"
"My house burned down, sir. May I start doing a bit of overtime? I'm going to need the money." Tom Bauer looked Rory up and down. He was young, fit, and good-looking, with a physique of someone who lifted a lot of weights in the gym. He was also currently dressed like someone who was lifting weights in the gym, and that wasn't acceptable.
"Rory, son, we have a dress policy here, and you know it. Thongs and a singlet is not what I'd classify as smart casual. I'm sorry your house burned down, but that doesn't excuse lateness and a disheveled appearance."
"My house burning down doesn't excuse lateness?" Rory exclaimed. He looked his boss up and down, middle-aged, average height, glasses, and a black mustache. Rory was sure he could take him.
"Tell me then, Tom, what does excuse lateness?" "Don't use that tone of voice on your superiors, or you'll be packing up your bags faster than you know it."
"I don't have any bags to pack. My fucking house just burned down."
"Rory," Tom warned, "you just take a few deep breaths, son. I could give you a serious reprimand for using that kind of language, but I'm willing to be compassionate because of what's happened. Go home, find yourself some decent clothes, and come back tomorrow. I'll let you leave without pay for today."
Rory Henderson took a deep breath in through his nose and let it out of his mouth.
"That's very kind of you, Tom. Do you mind if I get a coffee from the lunchroom before I go? I'm a bit upset about losing my goldfish. I just hope it was quick for him in that horrible inferno."
Tom Bauer crossed his arms. A split appeared in his comb over, revealing a pasty white bald spot.
"Go ahead. Just don't be distracting any of the staff with your sob stories."
"Wouldn't dream of it."
"Good. I'll see you tomorrow. 10 o'clock sharp."
10 sharp. Today was shaping up to be even more of a lousy day. It took all of his self-control for Rory to watch his boss retreating without yelling at him, or stabbing him with a pencil. As much as he was tempted to take out his frustrations, he knew he had to do the sensible thing and keep his job. On the other hand, without so much as a hi to any of his colleagues, Rory walked through the call center, past the plywood partitions, and into the kitchen. Several people were having lunch, but he pointedly ignored them, and headed straight for the hot drink vending machine. He pressed a button, watched as his black coffee made itself, then took it to the microwave and poured it all over the electronics. The kitchen erupted into activity as the microwave burst into flames. Rory quite calmly left them to their panic, worked his way back to the elevator, and caught it to the ground floor. Three security guards rushed into the lift the second the doors opened. Rory pushed his way past them and walked out into the foyer, which was practically devoid of all color and life. As he was exiting the building, a man in his early middle ages came running towards him, his expensive suit in disarray. Rory hadn't seen him before, but he looked unfriendly, stressed and humorless. Management. Without a doubt, management. Rory stepped aside and let the manager go past. "I bet he isn't going to be yelled at for his poor appearance," he mumbled as he walked out onto the street. It had clouded over during the 15 minutes Rory had been inside. A chill was in the air, so he picked up his pace. He considered stopping at the shops to buy some work clothes, but decided that he better not spend the money. There wasn't much left in his wallet. His bank account was practically empty, and his house had burned down. He might need to be frugal for a while. And then something unusual happened. The events that took place next would long remain a mystery to Rory. He'd been walking along the main street of the city, making his way to the train station. It was lunchtime, and the city was full of business people out doing their banking and sitting in cafes. Cars waited at traffic lights, and the haze of fumes filled the air. Basically, it was an ordinary day. When a crazy-looking guy had come running towards him, Rory had snorted in disdain and moved out of the way. You pass wackos by the dozen every time you walk through the city. But as the man came closer, a strange feeling washed through Rory. They made eye contact, and he felt a sudden urge to vomit. Rory found himself falling towards the ground in what seemed like slow motion. As his body neared the footpath, the light, sound, and stink of the day faded until his senses culminated spectacularly in nothing. No sounds, no smells, no sights, no tastes, no feelings. Nothing. Complete sensory deprivation. He could have been dead. As a dream seems to occupy an interminable length of time, so did this strange lack of sensation afflict Rory. It could have been a minute or a whole week before he found himself crawling back up to his hands and knees. A flood of sound and light overwhelmed him as his senses returned.
"Get down, motherfucker!"
someone screamed from right beside him. Rory winced in pain. The sound felt like a blow to the head.
"Move and you're a dead man!"
A heavy weight pressed down on Rory's back and he felt something cold and metallic being forced against his skull.
"What's going on?" he managed to croak. "I blacked out. I'm placing you under arrest for murder, arson, malicious damage, assault, and theft. Come quietly or I'll be forced to restrain you."
Rory felt hot breath on his face.
"And that means broken bones!"
Two policemen were hauling him to his feet. One had already handcuffed him.
"What's happening?" he protested. "I passed out. How did I get here?"
Fear and confusion filled Rory as he looked blearily around the unfamiliar environment he was in. Somehow, he'd left the city and was in one of those dilapidated suburbs usually inhabited by migrants or welfare cheats. It was getting dark, too. It must have been around 6 or 7 in the evening.
"One more word and you're in for a beating, scumbag."
The law enforcement officers dragged Rory toward the nearby car. The bewildered look he gave them must have been mistaken for a threat or a challenge, because one of them punched him hard in the kidneys. It took all of his energy just to remain conscious. As he was shoved into the back of the paddy wagon, Rory wondered how much lousier things could get. His house had burned down. His job was in jeopardy. He'd bribed a con man and copped a nasty fine, and he was being arrested for crimes he'd committed while unconscious. It wasn't a very good day. And things weren't going to get much better for good old Rory. Wednesday, mid-afternoon.
"Ian, thanks for coming into the office on such short notice. How you been?"
the tall man replied as he sauntered into the office room and sat down on the arm of the armchair. At the table opposite him were two serious-looking men in serious-looking suits.
"We've been very busy, Ian," the larger of the two men replied.
They were both pretty damn big guys, but one was about 6 inches taller than the other.
"We've noticed that you've started up a little side career."
Ian Albright leaned back in his chair and gave the man an appraising look. Bob, he called himself. It was unlikely that more than a few people in the entire world knew what his real name was, and it was equally unlikely that Ian would ever find out.
"I take it you're talking about my new work with City Rail," he asked.
"The transit officer thing." The big man nodded in reply. His face was carefully devoid of expression.
"Let me be straight with you, Bob," Ian said with a grin. "I love that job. It makes me a lot of money. It's extremely amusing, and I get a real kick out of tricking morons. You told me early on in the game that I should do nothing that might compromise my secret identity, and I haven't. I think that committing minor acts of fraud actually helps conceal that identity."
"How?"
the smaller man asked. He was known as William, and hated being called Willie or Bill.
"Well, Bill, it's simple. No one would expect a government secret agent to commit such petty crimes. If I ever got arrested for scamming civilians, you think for a second they'd believe I was anything more than a dull bludger trying to rake in a bit of extra cash."
The two men looked at each other. Bob picked up a mug of coffee and took a long draft.
"You're right, Ian. None of your status should ever behave like that, so no one would suspect you of having that status. It's a good cover."
He frowned suddenly.
"Are you bugged?"
Ian Albright smiled. "Unlikely, Bob. Aside from having to pass through all your screening equipment, have a look at what I'm wearing. Bike shorts? Don't you think I'd have noticed a microphone down there?" William peered over the desk at his employee's crotch, snorted, and leaned back in his chair. "Look, I'm sure you didn't call me in to give me a talk about the things I do in my spare time. What's going down?" The men exchanged another glance. Bob drained the rest of his coffee and spoke. "As you are aware, there was an accident at the Star Market Systems headquarters yesterday afternoon. From the reports we've received, it appears to have been a suicide. Paul Hirsch, a telemarketing manager, stood up and bashed his way out of a window during a board meeting."
"And he did all this by himself, of his own free will?"
"Precisely. It seems to be nothing more sinister than an ordinary suicide.
Ian nodded. This bloke definitely wasn't technology?
Correct. He was a genuine manager for the telemarketing front of the company. In fact, the most senior manager there. From the information we have gathered, it seems extremely unlikely that he had any idea what Star Market Systems actually do. They're good with their secrets.
Well, Jesus, I'd probably kill myself if I worked in the marketing industry. Just imagine how bad it would feel knowing that you're either going to get abused by your clients or trick them into buying some shit they don't even want.
The big men crossed their arms simultaneously, making it clear they were not interested in sociology. Ian smiled in understanding.
All right, then. So there was a suicide amongst the senior management team. Surely you've only called me here if there was something more important than that.
Very true, said Bob with a curt nod. When Paul Hirsch landed on the ground outside Star Market's building, a woman who was close to the scene ran away. This wouldn't be so strange if she hadn't been walking her pram at the time. She abandoned her baby.
William continued the story. Earlier today, we received some correspondence from one of our agents in the city. He saw a beaten-up woman standing outside an electronics store. The woman collapsed for no reason and started wailing about her baby. Then, a man who was near her ran off at full speed. We have confirmed that this woman is the same woman who left her baby at the suicide scene.
Ian waited expectantly for more. The two big men sat there, staring at him, their faces blank. When it became clear they were finished speaking, he stood up.
Is that it? Someone jumps out of a building and a witness goes mad? Should I go and assassinate the Prime Minister now?
William smiled grimly and pulled an envelope out of his jacket pocket. Here are the woman's details. Go and have a few words with her. See what she has to say about the incident. We're quite certain there's more to the story than Star Market Systems would have us believe.
Ian reached across the table and snatched the envelope. This job is starting to get interesting. I didn't quit the bakery so a couple of paranoid assholes who think they're all big and powerful could order me to interrogate crackpots about their offspring.
He shook his head, got up, and walked towards the door. This was really starting to disillusion him. When he'd heard about the job, it had sounded really exciting, full of mystery and adventures. He'd thought it would be like the X-Files, but it was turning out to be more like Neighbors. Bob called to him just as he was pulling the door shut.
Oh, Ian, there's one more thing.
What?
See what you can find out about the spontaneous human combustion that occurred outside the CBD at 12:15 this afternoon, will you?
To purchase an author-signed copy of Eyes and Knives with a 50% discount on postage, email helmpublishing@gmail.com with Shadowcast in the subject heading. You will receive an invoice through PayPal, and your signed copy will be posted to you upon receipt of payment. The music featured in this episode was The Cove by The Contrarian. Thanks for listening.